Hello and welcome to LSE Share Talk, Conker's Corner. This is Peter Higgins, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Leon Boros. Leon is a serial entrepreneur, a fellow of the Institute of Chartered Accountants, and currently the Managing Director of Equity Strategies. Good morning, Leon, and how are you today?
Good morning to you. I'm still recovering from the recent vote we've had and trying to work out how best to position myself for that. But yeah, very well, thank you.
Yeah, as indeed millions of others are doing it around the world, Leon, and unfortunately that's something we're going to have to cover at some point in this conversation, no doubt. Now, Leon, I know of you on Twitter, and I've seen your tweets, and I think we've spoken before in the past regarding some stocks. I just wanted to get your background, really, because I think there's still, unfortunately, a few others that are still not aware of the prolific nature of your investing over the years. So if you could just give us some background as to how you started, when you started, etc.
Okay. Well, I've been investing, I suppose, since I was 18. So I started seriously in my early 30s. And I took my wife and I in 1993. And have invested money in my self-select ISAs ever since. And I'm an economics graduate, and as you said, I'm a fellow of the Institute of Chartered Accountants. So that sort of helps give me insights that maybe aren't always available to the private investor. And I do run a corporate finance boutique, helping big companies buy private companies. So again, I'm fairly sort of close to what's happening in the economy and in financial markets, and I think that's given me some help over the years. I think I've come to some prominence in recent times because I wrote a piece about how my ISA has performed, a couple of years ago it went over a million, and by the end of last year it had gone up by a significant amount. On top of that, I think it's come back quite a bit since then. And I've recently written an ebook for the ShareSoc, the organization that promotes the interest of private investors, called 10 Key Lessons from a Millionaire. So that's been read quite widely, I believe.
Yes, it has been read quite widely. I was going to ask you about that, actually, because I was intrigued because I've read the Free Capital book, and I always wondered whether you were one of those characters in the book.
No, I mean, I know some of the characters in the book.
I do too, yeah.
I only actually got to know them after the book was published. So, no, I'm not one of the characters in that book, but it is a great book.
Fantastic book, yeah.
Any private investor who's thinking of in this full time should certainly read that book.
So if Guy Thomas does write another one, you'll definitely be in the second one, I would take it.
If he does, and if he wants me in, I'll be delighted to participate.
Right, okay. So I've got it here, and you've actually stated that you're an economics graduate, you're a fellow of Institute of Chartered Accountants, which gives you a great edge as into going into the finite detail of company accounts, etc. When you started at 18, Leon, do you remember what triggered your interest in the markets and what stocks you went into then?
I think it's something that I think you pick up from relatives, and certainly some relatives. My grandfather was a bit of an amateur stock picker, so I sort of got enthused by him. I think the first company I ever bought was a rubber plantation. I cannot remember where. I probably picked it up as a newspaper tip. I did very well with it, and then it sort of evolved from there, really. But really, it was only from my early 30s onwards that I sort of took it more seriously.
Okay, so given that you started early, and you got more serious to it within it much later on, what was your strategy like when you first started? You mentioned the newspaper tip there. Did you do much research back then, or?
Not in the early days. I mean, I think, you know, I think you will go through the same learning curve with shares. So, you know, I would probably follow tipsters. I probably didn't understand the importance of cash flow within a business. I certainly didn't understand how the balance sheet and the profit and loss account works. I probably was more susceptible to stories. And bitter experience taught me that you can be very careful with story stuffs.
Yeah, do you want to share that bitter story with us, Leon?
Sorry?
Do you want to share one of those bitter stories with us about story stocks?
Necessarily messing in, but one can think of the request. I mean, there was one disco, there was various other ones where there was a great story, brilliant promoters, very charismatic, physically.
Leon, I'm going to have to interrupt you there because the recording's going a bit low, and I'm going to just have to pause this for a second and just ask you to just have a look at your recording there and just move a bit closer to the mic if possible.
Okay. Hello, is this any better?
A tad better, yeah.
Yeah, there's also whistling, which I'm not sure if it's at this end or your end.
No, I can't hear anything at this end.
Okay, well, if you can't hear the whistling, that's fine. Is this any better? I've lifted it and got it much closer to my mouth.
It's a tad better, yeah. All right, should we press on?
Yeah, okay.
That actually sounds much better. All right, we'll carry on. So you were saying about, let's just go back a little bit. This is just saying about some of the stocks when you first started out with story stocks. And
yeah, let me just think of a story stock early on because I can give you a very good answer to that.
Yes, please.
Going back down memory lane, sometimes it can be quite tricky.
For all of us, yeah.
Okay, let me think. There was okay. Yeah, I've got one in mind.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So, well, a storage stock from the late 1990s, early 2000s was a company called Torotrak.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Was doing work in an adjustable gear device, I think. It had lost money for many years, but nonetheless, the talk was very positive from management. I remember buying it in some size in the late 1990s. I remember specifically when the directors were granted some options and those options vested and exercised, and they chose to sell those options in the market. And that was the sort of first red flag.
Yes.
And if management are speaking optimistically and positively about the business, and then, you know, not want to hold stock, you have to ask yourself why. And then there was a profits warning, I seem to remember, and the shares dropped significantly. And, you know, I learned a lesson there that it's important when the story changes to get out quick. And I don't think I got out quick at that point. I saw the shares come back further, eventually got out from memory. With a 60% loss or something like that.
Right.
I mean, the shares, they were around £4. I mean, when I last thought, they were in the pence. And the company still hasn't made any money. So that's just one example. And of course, during the internet bubble, there were lots of story stocks. I largely stayed out of the internet bubble when there was going to be Easynet, which again wrapped up at £5 and it went up to £20, £25. I even I had to remind myself a few months ago that I even took part in a placing, a very small
placing.
Right, okay. £22. And I almost couldn't believe that I could have been so foolhardy with the benefit of hindsight. But it shows you that when people are caught up, emotions are high,
yes,
people are being irrational, that even someone who thinks of themselves as being rational can succumb.
Indeed. I mean, we have a recurring theme on here about the levels of emotions in markets and the importance of psychology for all investors. And that is something that we keep revisiting here.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, that's a recurring theme. And I think confirmation bias is something we all suffer from.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think that over the years I've become better at dealing with that, and I've certainly got better and more disciplined in cutting losses and running profits. I think that's my natural state. My natural mental state is to run profits.
And indeed, that's been the best strategy for most people. Instead of, you've got to cut your losers and run your winners, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen research showing that you could get majority of your decisions wrong and still do extremely well on the stock market by running profits and cutting losses. And in fact, only when I reviewed my portfolio for the ebook, it was around about 60% of my investments have been successful and 40% have been unsuccessful. I was really embarrassed by those numbers. But what it shows is that I've still been able to do very well, and that's because of the discipline of running profits. And I'd say I'm much better at running profits than cutting losses, but I'm reasonably disciplined in doing the latter.
I don't think there's anything to be embarrassed with a 60% success rate there, Leon, given the fact that you've turned your ISA all the way beyond to the 2 million mark and wherever it is now. That's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's somewhat less than 2 million at the moment, but still well ahead of a million. And so, I mean, I've had an IRR of somewhere in the mid 16.5% when I last checked since 1993.
That's fantastic. I mean, the compounding on that is pretty staggering when you're looking at that sort of return. So, you're going to be way ahead of the vast majority of fund managers, never mind the 99% of the private investors.
Well, I think fund managers have some obvious hurdles they have to overcome. They've got regulatory costs. They get fired if they take too many risks. They tend to be index huggers. And they're all about amassing funds rather than necessarily getting the best returns. So I think that a private investor who's really puts their effort into this and meets with other private investors, listens to interviews like this, and develops the right mindset can certainly do better than an average fund manager. And that's not taking anything away from a fund manager. I think they do, on the whole, they're very, very bright people.
Yes, they do an
excellent job. But it really is for those people who aren't interested in investing, and are interested and want to do other things. Well, that's fine. And fund managers play a really important role.
Yeah, agreed. I think the private investors is like you and I. It's about being nimble and having the flexibility to do what you want if you have the freedom of that of the ISA or your SIP, and having the access and the freedom to do what you want when you want. Where, as you say, with some managers, they've got strict criteria they have to stick to and sectors, so they can't actually be as fluid as we can.
And also, I mean, how many times have you and certainly I've been able to nip out of a stock on a profits warning or where I've read something in an RNS that I'm not too happy with?
Exactly.
A fund manager, probably has to wait for the afternoon committee meeting or
yes,
before they can make a decision. And often you will see shares that have had warnings go to lower levels in the days following as the bigger institutions find their way out of the stock.
Very, very true. Very true. Now, Leon, I'm going to have to touch on the ISA stuff with you, and the fact you've done phenomenally well. But what I wanted to touch on before that, because you've already spoke about it, touched on it briefly, was your current situation with the fact that you're running Equity Strategies Limited, the boutique, and I know that you're dealing with some large companies, etc. But I just wanted a bit more of a background on it because I'm not fully up to speed with what it does, how it does it, etc. Can you just give us a bit of background on that, please?
Yeah, so it's an origination business. So the idea is that I come up with ideas of companies for my clients to buy, and those clients typically are larger quoted companies. And some of those I've secured as clients because I've come to their attention as an investor.
Yeah.
And also private equity houses who I work for, and I look for companies for them to buy, both in the UK and abroad. And in some cases, I'll continue to advise all the way through the transaction to completion. And in other cases, where the team have a very sophisticated or well-developed M&A team internally, that they will run with the transaction after I've originated it. I may have taken it to heads of agreement, and thereafter I step away.
Okay.
So clients include the likes of Capita, who I've worked with now for over 20 years. And on the advisory side, probably the largest one is a company called Benchmark, who I helped bring to the market via an IPO at the end of 2013.
Yes, I do know about Benchmark. I was going to ask, is Capital Equities that essentially the sister of or brother of Capital Strategies going back in 1992 that you ran?
Yeah, so that was a business that we sold. Capital Strategies was a business that we sold to management in 2001. I then became involved in my family's business, and Capital Strategies, then the people who bought the business after 3 years, I don't think they could bear to look at one another again, and they expanded. Equity strategies really is really a development from that.
Okay.
I'm still working with one of the people that I work with doing Capital Strategies. So I should say I came back into corporate finance about 3 or 4 years ago after this period of time, extended period of time with my family.
Okay. I mean, the family business was in bags and luggage. Was that correct?
So the family had around 10 or 11 stores in London and the South East, selling branded and unbranded fashion goods, handbags, luggage, as you say.
Yeah. So I was writing and describing you as a serial entrepreneur then, Leon.
An entrepreneurial investor. But I think, in truth, I'm much better at seeing others and picking other entrepreneurs back than I would say, myself. I've done okay myself. I've had no losses to show. But I'd say that my best skill, having met hundreds of successful CEOs, is that I'm really good at sussing out which people have got the right skill set in an area. They tend to be incredibly driven, focused individuals. People who've got a lot of courage often don't see the downsides of their actions. I'm far too focused on looking at both the upside and the downside. And there are also people who have greater capacity to control their events in their business lives.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I don't think always a great entrepreneur or a businessman necessarily makes a great investor, because I think investors have to adjust to how the world is. I can't use my force of personality to get the shares that I own going up in price.
Of course not.
I have to make sure I've spot the right managers to do the job.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that is a skill that I have.
And I would agree. I would agree with that. I think I spoke with your good friend Mark Bentley, and he's all about looking those fund managers and CEOs and CFOs right in the eye and attending as many AGMs as possible and listening to what they've got to say and comparing what they said the previous 3 months or 6 months. And that's when he makes his big bets and his investments in companies.
Yeah, I think that for any private investor, with not meeting management or finding ways of meeting management, it's a bit like doing a round of golf with four clubs. You know, you're going to put yourself at a big disadvantage.
Right.
That said, you do have to have the ability to read people. And I think some people have that naturally, and others have to probably learn it. And if it's not something that you're particularly skilled at, then find some friends who have got that, because you're probably bringing something else to the table. And I find that, you know, working with other people such as Mark is great, because it really means that you can cover your weak spots with other people's strengths. And as a group of you will often make a better decision than doing it alone.
I completely agree. This is why the social media is working so well with with people networking much better and sharing information much better. And invariably, with regards to what the work that ShareSog are doing now, is petitioning against certain companies that are up to no good and management that doesn't have skin in the game. So yeah, networks are becoming far more important now. So Leon, as an investor, how would you describe yourself? You've already touched on the fact that potentially you're a long-term investor. Leon?
Hello.
Would you describe yourself as a long-term conservative investor?
Yeah, I mean, I call myself a long-term investor.
Yeah.
But I'm probably not as long-term as someone like Warren Buffett. So right. I'll tend to, I don't have a set time frame, but once the story changes on a stock, I probably do look to get out. I don't like to sit around stale stories. But if a company's doing well and it's delivering on everything it's promised, then I will stay with it. The only thing that might tempt me to sell is just when the position size gets too big and disproportionate to the rest of the portfolio.
Okay. So do you want to give any examples of stocks that you've been in for a good while that you're still happy with?
Yes, I mean, one of those is Bioventix. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I know that's one of your favourites, yeah.
Yeah, I've been in there 4 years now. I have top sliced recently, but the position size, it has become far too big. I took a big position to start with because I was very confident. It has turned out well, but that position size now is too large. So I've cut it back. It was the most painful sale I've ever had to make. And I still wake up in the night thinking, why, oh, why? You've got to be sensible, I suppose. And
that's your discipline. That's that cognitive dissonance that you're fighting there, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I think so. You know, and we all know that sometimes the most painful decisions you make are sometimes the best ones because you've given the most thought to it. Mm-hmm. Whenever I think I'm brilliant and I'm decisions quickly, they usually end up bad.
Right. Okay. So, touching on that, then, do you have a sector preference at all, Leon?
Not really. I suppose I quite like financials because I can understand them more easily. I'm invested in IG Index as an example in that space. I've drifted into the biotech space, partly through the investment I've got in Bioventix, my interest in Benchmark, and in some other investments as well. And it's not something that comes naturally to me. I did very poorly at school in all the sciences, and so I'm having to learn again some of these things. But you know, that's the benefit of working with others. You know, I can bring my financial analysis skills to bear, I can bring my reading of people to bear, and sometimes I have to rely on others who maybe have stronger scientific or technical skills than I do. But that's been an area that has been quite significant of late. And if you bear with me, maybe we've gone to another question.
I was going to touch on your current liking of, or recent liking of the financial sector, and we'll just swing straight into the EU ref and what you think and how you feel that's going to impact the financial sector going forward.
I'd like to say I was shocked by the result, but actually I was not surprised. But I didn't really act in advance, which I had an awful Thursday where I became increasingly convinced Leave would win. And I know I'm assuming there that your most of your readers, listeners, were Remainers, and that's probably an incorrect.
It was very mixed, actually. It was very very split down the middle, our listeners.
And I certainly, from people in the city, I was surprised at the number of leavers there. And also, I knew plenty of friends and relatives who were leavers. And I could see some of the issues that have accounted for the frustrations of some of those northern towns and other places that were hot stance of remaining in the EU. But I didn't act, although I did start acting during the night. I was up the whole night with a spreadsheet and really tracking every single area by looking at the prediction versus the actual reality. So I knew quite early on that the Leavers had it. But no, I'm pessimistic. I'm pessimistic about Britain's short to medium term future. And I think that if you accept that discounted cash flow is relevant for company valuations, I think it applies to the valuation of the market as a whole. I think that we will be worse off in the short term, quite likely in the medium term. In the long term, well, those benefits may have discount back and have less relevance in the valuation. Clearly, if your business is relying on is selling in euros and dollars, and your costs are only in pounds, then actually things are going to be quite good. And actually, that is the case for Bioventics and some of the other stocks that I hold. But as the looking across the whole economy, yeah, I'm pretty negative forward.
Sorry, the last bit there went a bit fuzzy. You're saying you're pretty negative going forward about the markets?
Yeah. We're coming off a period of very high valuations, supported, I'd say, in part by low interest rates. Yeah. But if growth declines, and I'm convinced it must decline, then I think that you will see companies being derated. Now, yeah. Some will benefit from currency exchanges, and they will be able to post similar or rising earnings. But I still think even those companies will face a derating. And then, of course, the negative double whammy, or the double whammy, is where you get companies that have who don't benefit from the lower currency, but also suffer a derating as well as the market moves down. I think those stocks are going to do particularly badly. And I have opened up shorts in some of the house builders and in some of the retailers, the UK-based retailers, who I think are going to be particularly badly impacted.
I mean, because I was looking on Friday morning at the likes of Persimmon and Berkeley Group, the house builders, and they were getting absolutely hammered. You know, at one stage, yeah. I think Persimmon was down 40% for a multi-billion pound company. That was absolutely staggering.
Yeah, well, I've shorted Berkeley Homes, and they've continued to slide this morning.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised. I think the outlook for the property market in particular is negative. I mean, that's one of the silver linings I was able to express to my children who were very positively in favour of remaining, that at least now, well, one hopes now that the London property market will subdue and their prospects of owning a home in London have increased, assuming they are able to find meaningful employment.
Indeed, I mean the young voters, obviously, I think of a margin of 3-1 voted to remain, and they're very well disillusioned, disenfranchised, disenchanted over this weekend, and have already, you know, by the sounds of it, started their own petition to get have another vote on the referendum. So
yeah, I saw another referendum being proposed that Stuart Pearce be allowed to retake the penalty in the 1990 semi-final against Germany. So I think the vote is clear, and I think that the politicians need to try and honour that and understand the issues that brought that vote about. I mean, if the EU is flexible enough to come up with a revised deal which allows us to go back and ask the people again, then fair enough. But I think at this stage, I think it's clear that we've got to extricate ourselves from the European Union and hopefully do it in the least painful way. And, I'm not entirely negative about the long-term prospects, but I do think that short to medium term, we're going to suffer.
Yeah, I agree. I think, obviously, democracy has been had, and those that voted. So therefore, we have to now deal with the consequences. On a personal standpoint, I'm just a bit concerned that everything I've read thus far since Friday morning tells me that there isn't a plan. There isn't a plan A, B, or C, and it's just everyone's readying for what. So that's my only concern, really. And we're losing figureheads in the Conservative Party, in the Labour Party. We've lost Lord Hill, who was our spokesman in the EU, which, you know, for the financial services sector is absolutely staggering. So I'm just hoping that somebody comes together, comes forward at some point, given that George Osborne said absolutely nothing this morning, with a plan.
Yeah, I mean, people, I didn't see the Boris interview on Friday, but people tell me he looked like a very despondent winner. I think that was after Cameron had decided to go and leave the decision of the Article 50 with Boris or his successor to make. There's no obvious. I don't know what plan there is, but all I know is that there's the law of unintended consequences. We've already seen issues on which we could have anticipated. I have to say, I didn't anticipate the Irish question being brought back. And of course, we've now got Spain also making claims for Gibraltar. So there's going to be a lot of these unintended consequences. And, you know, if you look back through the history of mankind, revolution has rarely served the interests of the people that it was meant to.
Indeed.
And reform is always better. You know, I accept that a big institution like the EU is difficult to reform, and maybe shock therapy is the only solution for it. But when you go for revolution, you know, you've got to expect all kinds of possible outcomes. And of course, as an investor, it makes it even trickier because we've got to try and work out which way to, you know, how to plot our way forward.
Yeah, I mean, as the saying goes, great sailors aren't made at the harbour, are they? You know, the boats are going to be chopped about a lot in the next couple of weeks. So, indeed.
Hopefully that applies for our political leaders as well, that the great sailors will be made from the storms that we face.
Yes, indeed. So we've got the Scottish question. I'm sure we're hearing about Argentina wanting the Falklands back again at some point as well. Now we've got a depleted sort of services for the armed forces coming forward. So I'd like to move on now, if I may, Leon.
Sure.
If I could touch on, I mean, obviously you've done lots of different stuff as an entrepreneur, and you can speak to this on a personal standpoint or a family standpoint. It's entirely up to you, business standpoint. But what has been your wisest investment to date?
Well, I don't want to keep going back to buy ventures, but that has been my wisest investment.
Right, okay.
And maybe I should just explain the reasons why.
You can do, yes, please.
I first came across the Bioventics idea in 2012 by attending a meal at Mellow. These are events organized by a chap called David Streder. And he had Gervase Williams, the Mighton fund manager, in attendance. There was also another company called Silverdell presenting. I sometimes think back to that dinner and wonder if what would have happened had I decided to invest in Silverdell.
That went bust.
That went bust. He talked about it quite briefly. I liked the sound of it. It was very high profit margin, high returns on capital employed. And these things, as a sort of with my Buffett mindset, immediately attracted me to it. We managed to organize a meeting with Bioventics soon afterwards. Nothing much was happening. There wasn't much stock around. We had to sort of let it go. But I kept Peter Harrison, the CEO's business card, on my desk to remind me. And by good fortune, I called him some months later when they were trying to place a significant block of shares that a venture private equity firm had from the outset in Bioventics. So I was fortunate enough to be able to get involved in a placing of those shares at £2.60. I think that, you know, and it was a reasonable position, but that I've added to it since, both at £4.30 and then at £6 and also at £8. And I think, you know, people ask me, well, why have you taken such a big position? Because, you know, it is a small company, 10 or 11 employees. Peter could go under a bus. It does seem very risky. Mm-hmm. I think that's where understanding the importance of free cash flow, understanding the business franchise is really important, because, you know, I could see the numbers were telling me this was a very robust business. 71% net operating margins, 120% return on tangible assets if you strip the surplus cash out of the assets. And once I understood about its business, that it has a right to, it charges a royalty against the sales of diagnostics that utilize its sheep-based antibodies. I was able to see that it had visibility on earnings. It could predict to some degree its earnings out, 5 and 10 years. Yeah. And since 2000, since the early 2010 period, the licenses have been in perpetuity. Early on, Peter used to agree 10-year licenses and then realized he was missing a trick. There aren't many businesses where you have that visibility.
And no, there's
DCF
not.
I use all the time in corporate finance when we're valuing a business. But in truth, how far can you really predict? And I think when you look at Warren Buffett, the reason why he likes these strong consumer brands that, the likes of Gillette, where there's a lot of predictability, is that ultimately it means that he can use a DCF with a lot more confidence.
Because
he can peer further into the future. Mm-hmm. And those businesses do deserve a premium. And often when we're going back to the question about story stocks, often you have no idea what their cash flows are going to be.
In fact, some of them don't have any cash flow, do they?
And therefore, people will tend to overvalue those and ironically undervalue the likes of Biventix, which when I bought it was trading on a PE of 9.
Yeah.
And with the kind of financial metrics, that was just a huge and obvious buy. It has since been re-rated, but it is now off from its, it peaked at £12.50, £13. I think you can pick it up for about £10 today. I happen to think it's still very good value.
Yeah. Well, that points into complete contrast then with what's recently happened with Sacasta Pharmaceuticals, which had no revenues, but yet was valued at over £1 billion this time last year.
Yeah, no, that was, is that the cat allergy company?
That's a cat allergy one, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got a bit of a conflict of interest here because Benchmark, my client, are also developing a cat allergy. but in their case, their solution involves injecting the cat rather than the human, which always seemed a far more sensible scenario.
Right.
If given the choice between injecting my children or a cat, I'm afraid, as animal lover that I am, I would still choose the cat to get it,
not
my kids. So the valuation of Sacasta was incredibly high. They made a couple of acquisitions last year, which people wondered why. Did it suggest that they were running into problems with their trials? And it turns out that seemed to be in the case. I don't know the company ever so well. I did have a short on it some time back, which sadly I sold or bought back. So I didn't benefit from this big ratchet down. But there are lots of examples of companies like Sacasta that are more hope over value, which probably makes me skeptical about leaving the EU, because isn't that all about hope over?
That's a very good point, yes. I mean, the thing for me is you've got so many stocks out there that are invariably story stocks, and you've got an edge there given your background and your education as a chartered fellow of the Chartered Institute of Accountants. And I think what happens invariably is that the ordinary investor, shall I say, hasn't got the time or the inclination to do enough research. And I keep coming back to this in the sense that we have to do enough research. We have to do more than enough research so that we know, why are we buying into this stock? We're not following that person or that person. We're following all of the research we've done and then deciding, I want to put my money there because of these various reasons, not because it's been tipped here or that fund manager has bought that particular stock. But it still happens every day. It's like, oh, I've seen a tip here and I've seen a tip there. And I'm going, okay, and what research have you done on top of that? Nothing.
I mean, I would really suggest that for any of your listeners who, I think it's well worth them spending some money, getting a bit of training in being able to read balance sheets and understand cash flows, etc. Because I think that, education is so important. And, I lost a tidy six-figure sum, or close to a tidy six-figure sum, on a gold mining company a number of years ago. And I wish that I'd just gone and got myself educated. I didn't need to take the expensive route to education. I could have had it probably cheaper. That said, of course, we all know as investors, the most expensive lessons are usually the best lessons because they stick in the mind.
Unfortunately, that's very true, yes. But I mean, and saying that though, we have, and you'll see it on Twitter, there's so many accounts now which you think, oh, that person used to be quite prolific on Twitter, and you no longer hear of them anymore. And that's because their accounts have blown up, or they've just spent all their money on companies that didn't actually do anything, and the value of their portfolio is down 80% or 90%, and they're struggling to build the portfolio back up so they can actually invest.
I mean, we're all susceptible of looking at only the good scenarios.
Yes.
And I think that you know, and I'm as susceptible to anyone, but and there is a particular stock at the moment that I'm, which is a kind of special situation play that I'm in at the moment, that could be worth 2 to 3 times its current market cap, but could be worth 50% less than its current market cap.
Yeah, binary. Yeah.
And you know, you've really got to put yourself in the shoes of feeling what it would be like for the worst case scenario to come or happen.
Indeed.
Because if you can't live with that, then you shouldn't be in that position. And I think a lot of investors naturally look, you know, to the best case scenario, and don't look to the downside. And again, we can use the parallel of the EU again. In that.
No, that's a very, very great point about looking at both sides of the coin and being prepared and having a plan. You know, I'm ex-forces, and we're always told you've got to have a plan. You know, the 5 P's or the 6 P's, as we used to call it, prior preparation prevents poor performance, and you've got to be on your edge. You've got to be on your game all the time. And we have so many investors that are not prepared. And now we appear to have, you know, cross-party people, politicians who are not prepared. So I'm hoping that 2016 is going to be the tunnel that leads to some light in all kinds of spheres regarding that. Now, Leon, given the many lessons that you've learned since you were 18, which one would you most wish to share with our audience and listeners regarding the lesson and the lessons that you've learned? I mean, you mentioned the gold mining incident where you lost near a six-figure sum, but is there anything else that you wanted to share? You mentioned Bioventures as well.
My wife would probably kill me, but don't always listen to your spouse.
Oh!
I one of the first shares I held in my ISA was Nest, and I bought the shares on its turnaround at about 50-odd p, and the shares had gone up to £1.75, and you know, I was much less sophisticated in those days, and you know, I had 3 bagger, and my wife came back and said, look, this, I've just bought these trousers from Nest, and you know, they're already wearing out, it's really rubbish. So I sold, and of course although they've come off a lot recently, the shares peaked at £70. They've paid out £10 and £20 worth of dividends in that time. So, you know, I could have given myself a nice easy ride by just investing solely in Next over the last 23 years.
Yeah, I'm based in Leicestershire, and I know many individuals who were on the brink of being out of work with Next when they were, you know, when they really hit the wall.
When they were next to nothing.
And have since retired, and they've still got Next stock, Next shares in their portfolio, retirement portfolio. And they went down to 5p, 10p, etc. And they've still got them. And it's the best decision they've ever made. You know, they remain in gainful employment. They put in their PA, you know, their share scheme monies of £50, £20 a month, and they've made a staggering amount of money. So Lord Woodford, obviously, is Wolfson, should I say, has a massive fan base in Leicestershire.
I can believe that, and well done to them. I think it you know, sometimes when you're onto a good thing, you just keep at it.
Yeah.
So now, I mean, that was a jest, actually, because you know, usually listening to your partner it can be of benefit, and you know, my wife is particularly good at reading people, so often I will pull up a shareholder presentation or an AGM on the computer, and I'll say, look, can I trust this guy? And she'll usually give me the right answer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the biggest lesson really is, you know, I suppose understanding that a business is not about growth per se. It's not a turnover. It's ultimately about cash flow, and the cash flow that's returned on the capital that's invested on that business. And I think once you get your head around that, you're going to be a better investor. You're going to make fewer blue sky story stock mistakes. Yeah. You're going to back companies that not only generate profit, but convert that profit to cash. I mean, the most recent example of where I was very bearish was with Globo. I don't know if you recall that story.
I recall that story as well, yes.
Was generating operating margins of, I can't remember exactly, but something like 40%. I mean, a business generating 40% operating margins should see growing cash flow. You know, there is no business, even where they're, you know, even in the Silicon Valley, that can, that could generate that level of margin and not generate some positive cash flow. Of course, Globo never was able to generate positive cash flow. And, you know, understanding that is so important. You know, and I saw many private investors lose money there because they bought into a charming CEO and they looked at the profit, they looked at the P/E ratio and thought, oh, isn't it cheap? But they didn't do enough work on what's happening in the cash flow statement and in the balance sheet, where a lot of costs were getting dumped onto the balance sheet. A lot of revenue was being created as well, but not where the cash wasn't being received. So, you know, that's my accountancy training, partly down to being able to spot a spiv a mile off. You know, I was able to avoid Globo. But that's the biggest lesson, I really think, around those issues.
No, that's very good and valid points there. I mean, the concerning thing about the Globo one as well was that quite a few fund managers were duped into that as well and had large positions in that and kept reiterating the fact they're sticking with the story right until the very end.
I mean, what surprises me, but maybe it shouldn't, is how little work sometimes fund managers do on stocks. I think this is where a private investor has a huge advantage, particularly in the small cap space. And a typical fund manager in the small cap space has got to run a fund with 200 stocks in it. Otherwise, how are they going to get the money away? You know, they need that number of stocks. Otherwise, they're just really staying with a very small fund. And the cost of running a fund is such that you don't want a small fund. So the only logical way is having many stocks in your portfolio. But it does inevitably mean that they can't pay the same attention that we can. And, you know, if someone's relying entirely on, you know, a fund manager being in a stock, you know, that is dangerous. Particularly in a small cap stock.
I couldn't agree with that any more, Leon. That's such a good point. Now, taking the EU ref out of the equation that we spoke about earlier, anything you could change with regards to the investing landscape, what would that be?
I would like to see private investors being able to participate more fully in placings. I mean, as a, you know, I think they call it a professional investor or sophisticated investor, I do get access to placings, and sometimes those placings are at a discount, sometimes a significant discount to the market price. But it clearly is very unfair that I and fund managers can benefit from that, but the, you know, the average private investor can't. Now, until about 5 years ago, I had no access to that either, but I got involved with some other private investors, and, you know, together we've been able to sort of claim our seat at the table, if you like. But I would like to see, and this is actually an EU problem at the moment, I think you can only extend an offer placing if you're raising less than 5 million euros from other investors without issuing a full prospectus, which is very costly and time consuming, and you can well understand why many AIM companies don't want to go down that road.
Of course,
but I would like to see that limit of 5 million being raised to 10 or 15, but I would like private investors to get a fairer share of the cake. And, you know, ultimately, when they're investing in a small cap, a private investor has also got to ask themselves, if this is a cash hungry small cap, how much value will I lose over time because of successive placings being done at a discount to the intrinsic value of the business?
Indeed.
And a direct cost to myself.
No, there is so many cash-hungry AIM stocks and FTSE stocks that are burning through. The cash burn is absolutely ridiculous on some companies. So, yeah, they're doing very, very keep coming back cap in hand.
Well, we used to see a lot more rights issues, you know, in the 1990s, early 2000s, and now they tend to only be used by larger companies.
Yeah, that's true.
And rights issues is clearly are much fairer to all shareholders.
Yeah. I mean, the work that we mentioned, Mark, earlier, and ShareSoc, they're doing a fantastic work regarding all of those shareholder issues, as we might want to call them, in one lump. You know, I've got to give a shout out to the work that Mark's doing and the rest of the team, and David Streder, Carmen Speller, on Twitter. So yeah, it's a fantastic piece of work they're doing, and we can only hope with the likes of those sort of people involved that we'll have things on a level playing field, which is invariably what we're trying to do here on LSE Share Talk as well. I'm just going to ask you, Leon, have you had an indirect role with ShareSoc? I know you did papers for them and some blogs.
Yeah, no, I was on the board. I was on the board for a couple of years, but
right.
work pressures meant that I really just couldn't sustain that. So I resigned last summer, right. But I'm still involved. I speak at some of their seminars, you know, I published a book with them at the start of this year. Yeah. So, no, I really, really do recommend that people get involved with ShareSoc. I mean, the membership is tiny, £4 or something like that. For that, you get so many benefits. You get access to their seminars, to their usually held in central London, to their dinners, which are held in Richmond, to the education events as well. Probably the biggest benefit is you get a chance to meet other private investors. And there are some really smart private investors out there, and you learn so much from them. I mean, I remember talking to a private investor on a ShareSoc stand a couple of years ago who'd lost a lot of money. And I said, look, why not spend £40 here joining up to ShareSoc? And he just couldn't bring himself to do it. You know, he's one of those guys that has to learn the hard way. Well, there's an easy way to learn and a cheap way to learn. So that seems to me a rational thing to do. Join with others and learn together.
I completely agree. We have so many people and so many examples of people having to learn the hard way. And I mentor and coach several investors. And I'm always saying, you don't have to learn from other people's mistakes. You don't even have to learn from your own mistakes. You know, you can find your own strategy, but don't make it the expensive route. But invariably, some of them do. So, Leon, I wanted to touch on when you were starting out and looking at it now. Yeah. If there was something that you'd not considered when you were 18, when you were starting out, and you could actually implement it now, given all the learnings that you've had, what would that be? So you were unable to do something back then, but now you could do something, you know.
Yeah. No, I'm at risk of repeating myself.
Okay, okay. But, you can give another different example.
Don't follow the story, you know.
No, that's fine. Reiterate it. I think that's the whole point. Sometimes you have to reiterate things over and over again for people to get the point.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, the things that I did well when I was young was that I did stick to sectors I knew quite well, and that helped my portfolio right from the get-go. And I think that if you're starting out, you know, I disagree with a lot of the commentary around sort of young investors. I think they should be running concentrated portfolios. I think they should be focusing on areas of their lives that they know very well indeed. They've got limited time for research, and they don't have the amount of money to put into the market to justify huge amounts of research. So it makes much more sense to really focus on a number of areas, a small number of areas. But if you're young and if you can, you know, bear the company of older people since the EU vote, then come along to ShareSoc or one of these other organizations and get to meet companies. You know, that's something that I didn't have available to me, you know, 25 years ago. I could not meet a company, and I couldn't even see the company's management team online. You know, I just literally had to base it on the annual report. So really, you know, I was going on to a round of golf with a putter and not much else in those days, and I was still able to make it work.
Yeah.
But the key thing is, you know, when you're young, avoid throughout avoid story stocks unless you really know that well. that area well. Yeah, and of course, the other problem when you're young is that you generally think you're brilliant. You know, I think the only investors who are around a long time, and you mentioned the ones that disappear, are the ones who learn some humility over time.
Humility is a very, very, I'm very big on mindfulness, and humility and grace is what it's all about for me, and kindness. Now, one thing I forgot to touch on, so I'm going to have to go back a little bit, Leon, with you, is how where your portfolio sits now as a percentage, 100% of your portfolio. Where is it broken down? Is it across FTSE, is it across tech and biotech? Where have you got it?
Well, it's changed dramatically in the last few days, to be honest.
Yeah, it's changed.
But in terms of my total portfolio, I've got a big short on the FTSE 100, so that's minus 30%.
Yeah.
I'm long the FTSE, and this is individual shares that happen to be in the FTSE 250. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Long about 11%, and that's not working out well because, you know, the FTSE 250 is being impacted much more than the FTSE 100
at the moment.
The rest of my I've got 66% in AIM. Now I've got quite a lot of cash. I've got about 22% in cash, but because I'm short and the way I account for those short positions, I account for them as if I've sold them and therefore the cash has come in. So my growth, my overall, it's showing here as 50% cash, but in reality, it's 21% hard cash. And the way I account for it, the other 30% is made up of the other side of the shorts that I've got in play at the moment. In terms of sector, I've got around, this is of my net position, about 27% in biotech and science. About 10% in IT and internet. These are my own classifications, I should
say. Yeah, no, I understand that.
Around 10% in financials. I've got some in property. I've got a couple of sort of LXB, which is in wind down. That's in retail area, which I'm not very optimistic on generally, but I'm optimistic here that there's enough difference between market value and NAV for me to show a profit there. And also a company called Palace Capital that does commercial property outside of London, and I think that again they're showing a big discount to NAV, particularly as they've fallen in the last few days, but I think they'll suffer a little bit, but clearly not as badly as if you were in central London. I've got a bit in energy, a bit in support services at around 5%. And then I've got some gold, and I've got these various shorts that are in play. Some specific ones, individual ones, company ones, but also the FTSE 100 short. But I'm really trying to find myself a better short because I'm not sure the FTSE 100 is the best short to be holding right now. I've also got shorts in things like Tesla and Alibaba, which are both working out quite well at the moment.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
If one looks at the value of Tesla per car sold or per car like to be sold, it's just ridiculous.
Staggering valuations.
And you know, you've got to assume that the other motor manufacturers will come into the market at some point with similar product. Or I don't say that Tesla hasn't got a wonderful future, but the question is, you know, it's a difference between a great company and a great value.
Yeah,
valuation.
It's invariably going to be a very, very competitive space, and no one's going to allow Tesla to have that on their own. So all the major companies are going to be involved, and this talk, is Apple going to jump in? When is Apple going to jump in? You know, it's going to be huge. You know, so
we know from the history of the motor industry that, you know, returns on capital there are tiny.
Yeah,
and Tesla just bought in or made an offer for a company called Solar City, I believe, which is part owned by Musk, and which you know, I know that area is a great opportunity to lose money at the moment because of dumping from, you know, China and elsewhere. So and it relies so heavily on state sponsorship as well and subsidies. So I'm short there. But in terms of I think that's broadly where I am sat at the moment. But it has changed a lot since Thursday.
Thursday evening, yeah. It sounds like you've done what you've done regarding your ISA, and you've done exceptionally well. But it sounds to me like you keep quite a broad allocation, so you cover all the bases. So whatever the cycle, you've got quite a cyclical portfolio. So there's always something on the move regarding.
Yeah, I mean the bit That's true. I mean, you know, the ISA only makes up, you know, part of what I've got. I've got I've got SIP and I've got other accounts, and it's in the other accounts that I've been able to apply some of these strategies of late. So, you know, hopefully trying to mitigate the overall impact. With the ISA, you are more limited in the range of investments you can hold. So there you're looking at ETFs possibly to try and capture any bearish thoughts. And some, because I'm so heavily invested in AIM, some of the positions I've got are relatively illiquid. So, you know, selling those stocks is going to be tricky.
I think that's the beauty of having a couple of portfolios as well. You know, I have a trading account, and I've got my SIP and my ISA, but it's my trading account where I can be quite aggressive, you know, and very, very flexible. Whereas in sometimes I could be in a stock for a day, I could be in stock for a year or two or 3 years if I got the right company. But an ISA and a SIP, you don't want to be churning that much in those sort of holdings.
No, and actually, I have to say that, you know, I've bragged about my performance, but my best performance has been in my ISA. And I think partly for the reasons you've just suggested, that you're more likely to just stay with positions. Although the non-ISA part, the kind of, and the non-SIP part has come into its own in the, you know, more lately, and I think in bearish markets is more useful. I mean, the danger is you do put your more risky investments out of your ISA and out of your SIP. And in some ways it makes sense because, you know, you can carry capital gain. You know, if you make a loss, you've got a capital gains loss to offset profits. Yeah. So you're getting some help from the government there if it's not in a spread bet or in a CFD, if it's just owning the direct stock.
Yeah, you don't get that, yeah.
But I do think that you end up taking more risk there. And certainly, you know, my non-ISA, non-SIP historically hasn't performed as well as my ISA and my SIP.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I do take quite heavy risks sometimes in my trading account, and sometimes I think to myself, you know, when you've got to take that deep intake of breath sometimes, you think, Peter, maybe I shouldn't have done that today. Maybe do that tomorrow. Now, Leon, you've got Equity Strategies Limited, and I just wanted to touch on this because given the EU situation that we're in now, and realising obviously from your perspective and my perspective that a lot of investing for larger companies, private equity, etc., venture capitals are thematic. So if you were looking forward over the next 12 months to 3 years, if you were saying to investors, this is where you should be heading, these are the sort of companies you should be looking at, is there any region or sector that you think thematically we should be considering?
I mean, region-wise, I can't really offer anything valuable. I mean, I tend to focus on the UK market because that's where I have access to the companies. So I don't tend to think too much. And in the end, I just, you know, I would just be gambling really in terms of coming up with any themes that way. In terms of sectors, again, I tend not to focus on the sector. I tend to focus on the individual companies and trying to find the right kind of companies. I mean, I'm always looking for these companies that have high returns on tangible assets, high operating margins, good business franchise, but I'm often looking for the ones that are going to be the next Coca-Colas and the next Philips and what have you. I'm looking at that smaller and medium-sized companies that have to have both some growth, but also have the financial characteristics which will support them through good times and bad. And that's you know, partly what I'm relying on over the next few years, I think, that what I think will be quite difficult years for investors.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right on that count. I think everyone's going to be pulling the reins in, especially, like you say, with the London property market. And obviously, we're going to be looking at house price falls potentially across the board, north and south. It's going to be a quite thought-provoking period we're going to be going through.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong. I'd be delighted to shake Boris Johnson's hand and say, well done, you called this one right. I'd be much happier being right than wrong. I'd be much happier being wrong than right.
I mean, we started with the fact that there is no plan. I'm hoping by the time we go back on air and we check something, somebody might have actually gone, Eureka, there is a plan. So,
Well, I hope not, because I've got all these shorts.
Me, come on, Leon.
Me, always about me.
No worries. Now, Leon, thank you ever so much. I've covered all my questions. Is there anything else you wanted to share with us today and LSE Share Talk?
Nothing comes to mind immediately. No, but I've enjoyed the interview. It's been a good conversation.
No, you're most welcome. I'm ever so humbled by the fact you've agreed to come on. And I'm looking forward to you appearing in the next book as well, regarding the ISA Millionaires from Guy Thomas. I look forward to you. I'd like to know what sort of code name you would use. You obviously can't use Boris, because it might get,
No, I'm one of these. Name. I'm one of these strange people that would just use my own name.
Right, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Now, Leon,
I'm quite good at saying no to beggars.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Cool. Leon, thank you ever so much. And obviously, you know quite a lot of guys and women in the city and around in the financial sector. So please give them a heads up that I'm looking for individuals that would love to be interviewed for Conquers Corner, and keep the quality of the interviewees that we've done thus far at the standard that we've got. So thank you ever so much. And if you hear of anybody, please just forward their names to me or give them my email address.
No, I'll do that, Peter. Thanks very much.
All right. Take care.
Hopefully we'll meet up one time.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to do that. Yeah, I've been asking Mark to bring some of his ShareSog events a bit further north. And not a lot happens in Leicestershire, apart from the football and the rugby.
All right, then.
All right. Take care, Leon.
See you then. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.